Any idea who quite a few authorities believe was the worst president in all of U.S. history? A man who had extramarital affairs and paid large sums of money to keep them under wraps? A president who took part in a corruption scandal involving natural resources? A president who placed his friends in high government positions for which they had no background, resulting in those cronies embezzling large sums of taxpayer money through their posts? Sadly, those are common themes seen in political figures from around the world and at all ranks of government. But when you put these dishonorable acts together and examine the records of U.S. past presidents, one name rises to the top: Warren G. Harding, the nation's 29th president. Harding even died what many consider a suspicious death. He provides a wealth of historical forensic issues for us to examine. Warren Harding, the oldest of eight children, was born in North Central Ohio in 1865, just months after the end of the U.S. Civil War and Lincoln's assassination. Surprising to me, given the times, both of Harding's parents were doctors. He grew up in a small town, worked on the family farm, and graduated with a degree in journalism from Ohio Central College at age 17. Shortly after that, he and two friends bought the struggling newspaper, the Marion Daily Star, in Marion, Ohio, and turned it into a success. Harding often wrote the paper's conservative Republican editorials, and within a couple of years became its editor and sole owner. He was said to be charming, popular, handsome, and eloquent, and Harding became a local leader with roles in various fraternal organizations and charitable groups. In 1891, he married a wealthy divorcee, Florence Kling DeWolf, who was 5 years older than Harding and had a son from her previous marriage. She was also the daughter of a rival newspaper man. DeWolf was a driven woman. She allegedly pursued Harding until he proposed to her. She was extremely business-oriented and helped make the paper a success. She was also the one who encouraged Harding to go into politics. Harding referred to Florence, or Flossie as she was known to many, as the Duchess. And according to biographer Francis Russell, Harding said he married the Duchess for status and acceptance into society, not for love. Throughout his life, however, Harding is said to have loved many other women. In fact, one was a close friend of his wife's named Carrie Phillips. Phillips was also married to the owner of the local Marion department store, and although the Harding and Phillips couples frequently traveled together as a foursome, Warren Harding and Carrie Phillips carried on an affair behind their spouses' backs for 15 years. As events led up to Harding's presidential nomination, Carrie Phillips decided to leverage the clandestine relationship she had with him against the Republican National Committee. As a result, the organization paid her a monthly stipend to keep quiet and sent her on an extensive overseas trip. By this time, both Mr. Phillips and Mrs. Harding were embarrassingly aware of the tryst between their respective spouses. But Carrie Phillips had threatened to expose the affair to the broader public by using the numerous, quote, sweet and sappy love letters she had from Harding. She didn't, and Harding was elected president in 1920 in what was called a landslide victory. As an aside, those love letters have their own controversial legal history. Phillips originally gave them to Harding biographer Francis Russell to be released upon her death. But after she died in 1960, Phillips' daughter took up court proceedings to bar Russell from including them in his writing. With the help of some nephews of Harding, the love letters were sealed in the National Archives, with copies going to the Ohio Historical Society. They were slated for release to the public in 2023, upon the 100th anniversary of Harding's death. However, on the basis that the letters were no longer covered by copyright 75 years after the death of their author, who was Harding, Ohio attorney James Robinault obtained microfilm copies of the love letters and used them to write a 2009 exposé of the affair. Now, not only does Robinault's book reveal the intimate details of the long-standing Harding and Phillips relationship, it hints at other allegations. Both during and after her romance with Harding, Phillips spent many years in Germany, which may have changed Harding's life as well as world history. Robinault points out that Phillips was certainly a German sympathizer and could have been a German operative, and may have persuaded Harding not to run against Democratic incumbent Woodrow Wilson for the presidency in 1916, 4 years before Harding did run. Robinault's book points out that had Harding beat Woodrow Wilson in the 1916 election, which was a likelihood since Harding would have carried his home state of Ohio rather than Wilson, the U.S. may never have entered into World War I, all due to Carrie Phillips' love of Germany and her influence over Harding. Minimally, Harding would have been the war president rather than Wilson, and things may have proceeded quite differently in World War I. Now let's take a side journey to compare Carrie Phillips' extortion threat against Harding to a modern case in which another politician's sexual indiscretions got him into hot water. As I like to say, technological advances change both the tools to commit crimes as well as the methods to solve them. Plus, the evolution of society in general changes how we look at both criminal and civil matters. So, while Carrie Phillips had a paper trail of love letters from Harding, letters that forensic document examiners at the time likely could have easily validated as coming from Harding's own hand, Phillips took the hush money from the Republican National Party and quietly went away. Even the biographer to whom she entrusted the letters kept true to his word not to release them. Well, Anthony Weiner was definitely not so lucky. In 2011, Megan Broussard went before ABC News to help expose, pardon the pun, the sexual photography exploits of Weiner, who was then a U.S. Democratic congressman. In fact, rather than take hush money, Broussard accepted payment to reveal Weiner's indiscretions. Today's digital technology has revolutionized the ability to nearly instantly trace communications to their source. And that's what happened when the married congressman sent a graphic image of himself, unbelievably using his public Twitter account, to a 21-year-old college student named Jeanette Cordova in 2011. Although Weiner's post was nearly immediately removed, it had already been captured by another Twitter follower and then forwarded to a political blogger. When that source made Weiner's naughty image public, the congressman's reaction was to use his own modern technological excuses. He said his account had been hijacked, and those were either not images of him, or they'd been digitally modified to appear sexual in nature. Weiner claimed this was a prank intended to damage his political career, but said he would hire his own private investigators rather than have the FBI look into the case. That's pretty curious. Apparently, this sexting, or would we call it sex twittering, was just the tip of the iceberg. Not only had Weiner been sending similar and worse images to young ladies for several years, but suspicious political adversaries had been monitoring Weiner's electronic communications for months, even going so far as to use the forensic technique of posing as potential victims, in this case, young women, to try to bait the congressman. When Megan Broussard learned about the photos Weiner sent to Jeanette Cordova, Broussard confided to several friends that she too had gotten similar images from Weiner. One of those friends, with ties to the Republican Party, convinced Broussard to share her story with a conservative blogger who broke the lid off it. Shortly after that, ABC News reportedly paid Broussard between $10,000 and $15,000 to supply them with a batch of images, emails, and cell phone logs that documented Weiner's shady behavior. Broussard claims she exposed him because she was disgusted, not so much by Weiner's behavior, but by his adamant denials. She said she didn't do anything wrong, didn't have anything to hide, and was afraid if she didn't tell her story, the media would. And we all know that's true. In fact, just as soon as Weiner learned that ABC was in possession of his messages to Broussard, he held a press conference and admitted he had lied when denying he sent such images. Okay, now let's return to Harding's infidelities. Among his lovers, and concurrent with his affair with Carrie Phillips, was another Marion, Ohio woman named Nan Britton. She was 30 years younger than Harding. In fact, Harding and Britton's father were friends. Apparently, Britton became infatuated with Harding when she was a teenager, and he ran the local newspaper. In the 1927 book she wrote, entitled The President's Daughter, Britton claimed that in 1917, at the age of 20, she lost her virginity to 51-year-old Warren Harding in a New York City hotel room, and that moments later, the New York City vice squad broke down the door. But discovering the older man with this young girl was a U.S. senator, the authorities left the couple alone. Imagine anybody keeping that secret today. As the affair continued, Harding set Britton up in a house in New Jersey near a casino where he gambled. In time, Britton became pregnant and in 1919 gave birth to a daughter at home rather than in a hospital. Britton asserts the romance continued into Harding's presidency and that she and Mr. President had sexual encounters in the White House, including in a closet off the Oval Office. Sound familiar? Allegedly, Harding never met Britton's child, let alone claimed to be the little girl's father. But nevertheless, he did provide Britton with financial support. Some sources suspect Harding may have been infertile and therefore couldn't have been the girl's father, since he had no children with his wife, yet she had a son from a previous marriage. Still, if Harding claimed to have married Flossie DeWolf for status and money rather than love, perhaps his sex life was exhausted with his mistresses, not his wife. So did Harding have a child with Nan Britton? That's never been conclusively proven. But what about the possibility of paternity testing in the case? You may know that blood tests were the original means of assessing paternity. ABO blood groups were discovered at the turn of the 20th century in Austria, but also concurrently in Czechoslovakia. By the 1920s, it was established that blood types were inherited, and this was the key to their use in establishing paternity. Britton's daughter was born in 1919, and blood group paternity testing began being used around 1925. But it wasn't until about 10 years later that some U.S. states started accepting ABO testing in paternity suits. The thing about blood testing, though, is it can only exclude a man as being the alleged father of a child. It can't prove he is. The four basic blood types are just too common in the population for a simple blood group match to be positive evidence of parentage. Since the mid-1980s, modern paternity testing, which is a form of forensic analysis, has relied on nuclear DNA comparisons. Nuclear DNA is inherited from both parents and can be found in all body cells, except red blood cells, which lack a nucleus. Although the original DNA-based paternity test did use blood, they extracted the DNA from white blood cells, which do have a nucleus. Mitochondrial DNA can't be used in paternity testing, because that form of DNA is inherited only through a person's mother. Still, given today's nuclear DNA capabilities, today's high-profile political paternity scandals surely always involve DNA testing, right? Well, surprisingly, that's not as common as you might think. In 2011, the day after California governor and action film star Arnold Schwarzenegger left office, he accompanied his wife, Maria Shriver, from the Kennedy family of U.S. politics, to a couples counseling session that she had planned. The basis of the meeting was allegedly to discuss the family's adjustment to life after the governorship. But the first issue Mrs. Schwarzenegger raised was to confront Arnold with her long-standing suspicions that he was the father of their former housekeeper's son. Although Shriver had questioned her husband about this infidelity for years and he had denied it, that day he finally admitted it. Shortly thereafter, Schwarzenegger made the affair public and expressed regrets for what he'd put his family through. The other woman was the couple's recently retired housekeeper and personal assistant, who was a 20-year veteran of the Schwarzenegger family's staff. Mildred Patty Baina had given birth to a son 14 years prior, but separated from her husband 3 weeks after the boy's birth. Not only did Baina raise her son in the household's extended family, Shriver and Baina were literally pregnant with their respective Schwarzenegger sons at the exact same time. The two boys were born only 5 days apart, and they likely played together at times. early media allegations that Schwarzenegger took a paternity test were false. He never even suggested DNA testing. In his 2012 autobiography, Schwarzenegger admitted he realized the boy was his due to the strong resemblance that started when the child was only a toddler. At that point, much like Harding and his mistress, Nan Britton, Schwarzenegger started to give Baina extra money and kept her on staff to, in his words, control the situation. He even bought her a new home in 2011 after her retirement. Now, Baina later said Maria Shriver confronted her before the couple's counseling session, and that she told Shriver the truth even before Mrs. Schwarzenegger forced her husband's admission. It's amazing to me that this affair was kept quiet for over 14 years, especially considering it happened even prior to Schwarzenegger's first and successful run for governorship in 2003. Contrast this with the infidelity of John Edwards. In 2004, while still a North Carolina U.S. Senator, and during the time his wife was battling breast cancer, Edwards was a Democratic presidential hopeful. He didn't get the nomination, but ultimately ran for vice president in 2004 alongside John Kerry. Although they were defeated, Edwards announced his intention to seek the presidential nomination 4 years later. But beginning as early as 2007, allegations began to surface about an extramarital affair with one of his campaign staff, cinematographer and sometimes actress Riel Hunter, resulting in considerable damage to Edwards' political career. Things got worse when it became obvious Hunter was pregnant. Hunter gave birth to a daughter in early 2008, but didn't provide the father's name on the birth certificate. Instead, she went to the tabloids and said that Andrew Young, one of Edwards' top political aides and closest friends, was the father of her child. Unbelievably, Young not only went along with this, he and his wife took Hunter into their home where they live with their three children. But the whole thing was an elaborate scheme Edwards cooked up to cover the fact that Hunter was his mistress, not Young's. Among the more outrageous details was Young's eventual revelation that Edwards asked him to get one of the baby's diapers and have a paternity test done to see if Hunter's child really was his. DNA can be obtained from nearly all bodily tissues and excretions these days, not just blood. Young also said Edwards wanted him to find a doctor that would exonerate him by falsifying any paternity test results that turned up positive. As time went on and allegations continued to swirl that he was the baby's father, Edwards agreed in an interview to take a paternity test. But Riel Hunter said she'd have no part in it. Finally, when Andrew Young decided to come clean on ABC News in early 2010, Edwards admitted he was the father of Hunter's child, who by this time was almost 2 years old. Edwards said he had been and would continue to financially support the child. And that's what he was ultimately indicted with in 2011, since that support had come in the form of over $1 million of misappropriated campaign funds. Although he was not convicted, the situation did serious damage to any political future Edwards may have had. One far lesser known political sex scandal did ultimately lead to a paternity test. You may not have heard of Minnesota Senator David Durenberger, but in 1993, a woman alleged he raped her back in 1963, causing her to become pregnant. Durenberger's denials were just as strong as Edwards had been, but paternity blood testing by a Minnesota lab definitively excluded the senator as possibly being the father of the woman's near 30-year-old son. Of course, paternity testing isn't the only reason we do DNA testing in sex scandals. We all remember the famous blue dress worn by White House intern Monica Lewinsky while having sex with then-President Bill Clinton in 1997. As the tryst became public, despite Clinton's steadfast statement that he did not have sex with that woman, the FBI ordered the president to submit to a blood sample in 1998, and it showed that the semen stain did, in fact, contain presidential DNA. Now, let's look beyond the sex scandals and examine the disastrous political life of Warren Harding. During his rise to the presidency, Harding served not only as a U.S. senator, but also as lieutenant governor of Ohio. a role through which he made many state connections. In fact, one of his main political advisors from Ohio, Harry Daugherty, promoted him towards the presidency because he thought Harding, quote, looked like a president. Harding made what have been called lofty speeches and was a Republican conservative. He wanted to return the country to what he called normalcy after World War I and the progressive policies of his predecessor, President Woodrow Wilson. But Harding had what some might call a mixed platform. He progressively backed women's voting rights, perhaps due to a strong mother and motivated wife, but conservatively supported prohibition. Harding lowered taxes and helped end strikes and race riots, and while he supported efforts to rebuild post-war Europe, he opposed joining the League of Nations. Overall, though, Harding told close friends and advisors he was, quote, overwhelmed with the job and not prepared to be president. Harding delegated both work and decisions to others, preferring to be what he called a more ceremonial president. As such, he rewarded old friends by appointing them to political positions, including making his Ohio advisor Daugherty the nation's attorney general. Along with that came Mr. Jesse Smith as Daugherty's assistant, who had additional roles as, quote, general gopher and bootlegger, despite Harding's lip service to prohibition. Other members of what is now known as the Ohio Gang will figure into our story. Albert Fall became Secretary of the Interior, Charles Forbes became the first ever Director of Veteran Affairs, and a private investigator named Gaston Means, who was said to be exceptionally adept at extortion, was made an FBI agent early in Harding's administration. Means was a consummate con artist who had an extensive history with the legal system, in a bad way. He was a forger, thief, and had been accused of murdering one of his private investigation clients. An entire lecture could be created about Gaston Means. In fact, after Harding's death, Means even attempted to extort ransom money during the kidnapping of Charles Lindbergh's son. Means wasn't actually involved in the kidnapping, but ended up dying in prison for his extortion stunt. But back to Harding. The guys from the Ohio Gang were involved in among the worst of the Harding scandals. They met weekly in what was known as the Little Green House on K Street in Washington, D.C., where they played poker, drank, and had wild parties that some sources have called orgies. But that's not been substantiated. I should also mention not all of Harding's appointees were bad boys. In fact, Herbert Hoover, who Harding made Secretary of Commerce and would later become the 31st President of the U.S., seriously denounced the Ohio Gang. So let's dig into some of Harding's political scandals. If you studied U.S. history, you may recall the Teapot Dome scandal. Prior to Watergate, it was largely regarded as America's greatest political scandal. And here's the gist of it. Before Harding's presidency, the government acquired three large plots of land, two in California and one in Teapot Dome, Wyoming. Now, these contained huge reserves of oil. The oil was set aside for use by the U.S. Navy to help shift their fuel sources from coal to oil. Congress had given the Secretary of the Navy power to oversee the reserves. But just 3 months after Harding was elected, his Secretary of the Interior, Ohio Gang member Albert Fall, convinced the Secretary of the Navy to turn the responsibility over to President Harding. Harding, in turn, put Fall in charge of the oil reserves. Then Fall leased the land to some of his cronies in the oil business, netting himself $360,000 in bribery money. The Wall Street Journal had been digging into the story, which they broke on April 14, 1922. As a result, a Senate investigation was undertaken, resulting in Hardin's appointee, Albert Fall, becoming the first former cabinet member to ever be sent to prison. Now here's another one. The conclusion of World War I saw many injured soldiers returning home. So Harding created a position called the Director of Veterans Affairs, which many people applauded. But then Harding appointed Ohio Gang member Charles Forbes to the post. Forbes was allocated $500 million of government money to devote to the care of the veterans. He was also assigned to hire 30,000 people to build and staff VA hospitals throughout the country. But in less than 2 years, Forbes had embezzled $225 million of those dollars. That's almost half the allocated money. When the dust settled, the investigation revealed Forbes allowed improper bids from contractors that he bribed, and he purchased and resold hospital supplies for huge profits. Forbes also turned down legitimate disability claims and didn't fill jobs at veterans programs. He instead pocketed the money that was set aside for those obligations. One of Harding's confidants was Charles Sawyer. Sawyer was Mr. and Mrs. Harding's personal homeopathic doctor, but some gave him little credibility as a physician. It's said he took no salary from the couple, but Harding did make Sawyer Brigadier General of the Army Medical Corps. In return, Sawyer was at least the voice of reason with regard to the Forbes case, that abuse of the new Veterans Affairs system. Since Sawyer was the one that persuaded Harding to call for Forbes' resignation in 1923. Forbes was convicted of defrauding the government, fined $10,000, and sentenced to 2 years in jail, but he was released early. We'll talk more about Dr. Sawyer in just a few minutes. Now, earlier I mentioned Jesse Smith, who had no real official title, but was Attorney General Daugherty's aide. Smith was also Daugherty's roommate. In fact, there were rumors the two men were lovers. Among Smith's illegal activities for Harding and the Ohio gang was obtaining liquor for both the K Street parties and the White House. Smith also sold licenses for alcohol sales, licenses that were only supposed to be given to registered pharmacies, and he took money from various bootleggers in exchange for federal protection. There was no great forensic investigation necessary to figure all this out. Smith kept meticulous records on his alcohol-related crimes and transactions. In 1923, as political scandals and suspicions heated up, Harding decided to take a damage control campaign trip, hoping for a 1924 re-election. The trip was supposed to take him out west and then on to the Gold Rush territories of Alaska. Before leaving, Harding supposedly told Attorney General Daugherty he wanted his alleged boyfriend, Jesse Smith, gone from Washington by the time the campaign trip ended. Smith was later found with a gunshot wound to his head in what was ruled a suicide. But people who knew Smith said he had an intense fear of guns, and many believe he was actually murdered because he knew too much about the illegal operations of the Harding administration. Although those murder allegations were even raised within the U.S. Senate, the suspicions related to Smith's death were never proven. While in Alaska, accompanied by Dr. Sawyer, Harding took ill. A Vice Admiral U.S. Navy physician named Dr. Boone diagnosed the problem as a heart condition, in particular that Harding's heart was enlarged. But on his return voyage from Alaska, Harding got worse, and Dr. Sawyer believed Harding had food poisoning from some seafood he'd eaten. Sawyer treated the president with purgatives to induce vomiting. Now, anybody that knows much about physiology knows a body has to have the proper balance of ions, called electrolytes, in the blood, especially to maintain proper cardiac function. And vomiting can drastically change the body's ion balance. Well, the ship docked in Seattle, and Harding was able to deliver a planned speech. But by the time he traveled by train back to Oregon, Harding was so weak he had to cancel his address. Fluids had been accumulating in his lungs, and as a result, he had developed pneumonia. From a clinical standpoint, an enlarged heart, body weakness, and fluid in the lungs are all classic symptoms of congestive heart failure. When Harding was taken to a hotel in San Francisco, a number of doctors examined him. One even prescribed the heart medication Digitalis. But on August 2, 1923, with only his wife Florence in attendance, Harding died in that San Francisco hotel room. On advice of Dr. Sawyer, Mrs. Harding refused to permit an autopsy, and the president's body was quickly transferred to the train depot and then on to Washington for a funeral. Can you imagine a sitting U.S. president that died under those circumstances not being autopsied today? As you might assume, suspicions were immediately raised about Dr. Sawyer's medical care, and whether Florence Harding may have just finally had enough of her husband's philandering and poisoned him. But the conferring physicians agreed the cause of death was apoplexy, what we'd today call a stroke. Dr. Sawyer resigned from his position with the Army Medical Corps and returned to Marion. Mrs. Harding stayed briefly in Washington, D.C., but on the advice of Dr. Sawyer, she also soon returned to Marion, where she died in Sawyer's care the following year. Florence's son, who had been raised by her parents, had died nearly a decade before when he was just 34 years old from alcoholism and tuberculosis. A look at both the life and the death of Warren G. Harding illustrate the types of scandals and mysteries that have surrounded politicians since the dawn of government. In the past, the true stories of many such incidents may have been lost to history or personal discretion. But today's media, along with modern forensic technologies like DNA paternity testing, digital evidence of communications and financial transactions, as well as advanced autopsy and toxicology techniques, those can all be used to seek out truth whenever dirty politics or politicians are suspected.